Thank you. So, well, thanks to the organizers for the invitation. And this is there is some. So this is joint work with Ion Nekita. I should first precise it. And this is very much unrelated to what Ion talked about. Somehow we had the same motivation, namely to try to understand. Patrick Haydn and Haydn and Winter's counterexample for the additivity of the Regnier entropy for every p strictly bigger than one, and also to try to understand the Hastings paper. So probably the only thing which for the purposes of this talk, the only thing which you need to remember about Ion's talk is that there was some matrix Z which was depending on N, which was actually a K square matrix, and whose eigenvalues were tending towards the following number, so T plus 1 minus t over k square for the biggest eigenvalues, and then 1 minus t over k square, and that was k square minus 1 times, and this was almost surely as n was tending towards infinity. So I also take this occasion to speak about, so I will basically be using the same notations. So the problem which I am interested in this time is the following. We have some two finite dimensional Hilbert spaces, and let's say that, for example, this one is of dimension k and that one is of dimension n, and I choose a Hilbert subspace here H. M, let's say, which is.
Well, perhaps you should avoid using the lower board, the side of the room can't see through the.
So, let me repeat that one. So, what I was saying is that we are considering a random subspace here, which was of dimension Tn. Okay, let's say integer part to make things a little bit rigorous. And this is a Hilbert subspace of the space V tends W, where this one is of dimension K and that one is of dimension N. And so the spirit of the talk somehow is that we have T, some number which is in between 0 and 1 and which is fixed. We have k, which is any integer, greater or equal than 2 maybe, and we want to understand what happens as n tends towards infinity. So, more precisely, what do I want to understand? Here I take this subspace as random, so this is a random variable. If you want, this is an element in the Grassmann manifold of this Hilbert space. So at random, with respect to the Haar measure, and I want to understand which properties with respect to entanglement. So of course, M is entangled. Sorry. As in M is non-entangled. Is non-entangled if and only if. There exists some x in M, which I can write x as E tends F, where E belongs to V and F belongs to W. And what I want to, so what we want to understand is what is depending on T and K, what is the probability that M is entangled as N tends towards infinity. We need somehow to quantify this. So there are already known results about this. Let me set a little bit more of notation. Let me maybe take some element x in M, which is going to be of norm 1, of Hilbert norm 1. So I can always write x as a sum. Let me say here also, well, since n is going to tend towards infinity, I can always assume that k is less or equal than n. And here I am going to, I can write sum for I between 1 and k of lambda I x square root ei tends fi, where these are orthonormal orthonormal vectors. And so, well, one of the well-known measures. So this has been mentioned quite a lot. HP of, well, I don't know if this is such a standard way of writing that, but so one over 1 minus p logarithm sum for I between 1 and k of lambda I to the p of x. And so for p tends towards 1, we have the so we have h1 of x equals minus sum for I between 1 and k lambda I of x log lambda I of x. And one natural way to try to quantify the entanglement is to look at maybe something which we could denote, well, some which corresponds somehow to the minimum, to the p minimum output entropy, which was mentioned by Ion previously, which would be associated to any unitary inclusion of m into a v tens w, v, and this is so this would just be the mean over x of HP of x for x belonging to M and of norm 1. So we have already many results here, which I'm not going to mention again. So which were mentioned by Chris King yesterday. So there is one result by Hayden, Long, and Winter. Well, basically for saying which is the for this measurement of entanglement, what is the likelihood when the parameters t, n, and k have some asymptotic behavior of having some my random space M to be entangled, and this has been refined very recently by King, Fukuda, and Moser, according to ideas of following the ideas of Hastings. And the common point between these two approaches is that they rely on some specific measurement of entanglement, so on a real valued function, one of these minimum output Renyi entropies. And well, having a background in random matrix theory, somehow I was interested in trying to understand what we could say directly about the values lambda I instead of looking at a function of these values. So instead of looking at an entropy. So this is what I want to speak about today. So maybe let me state it as an open question, which I will give a partial, which I will answer partially today. So maybe um, the question would be the following. I could, so okay, so what I can do is look at lambda I of x. Maybe I could assume also that lambda 1 is bigger than lambda 2 and so on. Okay, I can order them and assume that that they are all non-negative, that they are real numbers bigger or equal than 0. And so this here, I can see it as an element of R to the k of veil chamber of R to the k, so as a decreasing as the non-increasing sequences in R to the k. And so the question is the following: let me consider k sub n, which would be the union for x in M, x of norm 1, of lambda I x, so this is a point here in R to the k, and, well, to make things a little bit more more natural and maybe a little bit easier to deal with in asymptotically, let me look at the convex envelope of this. Well, this is, we could think of it as a measure also of the entanglement of the space M in V tends W. This is a random compact set. This is a random set. Okay. And what I want to know is what is the behavior of that random set as N tends towards infinity. So behavior of M of K sub N as N tends towards infinity. So typically one of the questions which I could be interested in is look at the limit sup of K N and try to describe it almost surely. So for example, describe the limit sup of this almost surely as N tends towards infinity. In the hope that this will complement nicely to that channel estimate that we already have. So it turns out here that there is some interesting relationship with random matrix theory, and there is a nice interaction between random matrix theory and free probability here. So let me, Patrick already spoke a little bit about free probability. Let me just mention one result that will be useful for us. So it's the following theorem, which is basically due to Voiculescu. Probably this is the concatenation of two or three results of Voiculescu. Let P and Q be two projections in MD of C. And let's assume that they are random and they are independent from each other. So they are random and independent from each other. Independent from each other. And in addition, I'm going to assume that the trace of P behaves like alpha D, and the trace of Q behaves like beta D. So you see, actually, I should put an index d here, but I'm going to omit it. And what Voiculescu tells us is that these matrices, as this grows very very large, are asymptotically free, and there is a rule for computing the joint distributions of these random matrices in the sense that Patrick was mentioning. And if one looks at some very specific functional, non-commutative functional, let's say non-commutative polynomials in these two variables, it's possible to make some very precise analytic statements about this. So, for example, for our purposes, let's look at P, Q, P. So what you should think of is that I have my randomly rotated projection, and I'm taking a corner of it, okay? And what I would like to do is to try to understand how its eigenvalues behave. So what we have is that, so let's say that once again, it has eigenvalues, maybe mu1 bigger than mu d are the eigenvalues. So they are random, of course, but they're not that much random, actually. So if I look at 1 over d sum for I between 1 and d of 1 of the Dirac mass at mu I, what I have is that as d tends towards infinity, it converges towards a measure which I'm going to write down because we will need it. So a measure mu, which satisfies the property that I'm going to make one extra small assumption, which is okay. So of course alpha and beta both belong to 0, 1. What I will want to assume, although technically Voiculescu doesn't need it for us, this will be interesting. Alpha plus beta is less or equal than 1, which means that that's basically, well, if alpha plus beta were strictly greater than 1, this would mean that automatically the images of P and Q would intersect, so that would be a large eigenspace. So what we have in that case is that nu is delta 0 times the inf of alpha and 1 minus the inf of alpha and beta plus some continuous distribution which looks like this, square root of phi plus minus x x minus phi minus divided by, I need to check my constants here, 2 pi x 1 minus x 2 pi x 1 minus x dx, and this is of course for 1 between phi plus, phi minus and phi plus, where I should tell you what phi plus and phi minus are. Phi plus or minus is alpha plus beta plus or minus square root of 4 alpha beta 1 minus alpha 1 minus beta. Okay, so this is, and what this tells, so this is an explicit formula. It's not actually simple at all to prove this formula from the simple definition of free probability of freeness. One really needs some functional calculus tools, one which is called S transform, which was introduced by Voiculescu to obtain this kind of result. So what one sees here is that if alpha plus beta is strictly less than 1, then phi plus is strictly less than 1, which means that the So we have an atom at zero, okay, and then we have phi minus here, phi plus here, and we have one, and we have something, we have some distribution here. So what this tells is that the eigenvalues, statistically, well, there are lots of trivial eigenvalues, but this is clear because we have been cutting it by a projection. So these ones are trivial somehow, and all the other ones they live in this interval, at least statistically. Now, the problem somehow, we are not so much interested, unlike the case of free probability, about just the behavior of nice randomly of the almost sure behavior of nice randomly chosen random matrices. What we want is really to understand all elements, all x's in M to be able to say something about H mean of the space M itself. And what we will see is that this amounts also to being able to say something about the norm, the almost sure L infinity norm of this random matrix. So what this result implies here is that, well, you have many eigenvalues who live here, but what it doesn't tell, for example, is that there could be a few eigenvalues who are here, or a few eigenvalues who are here, which could still mean that the norm of this random matrix here is big. Actually, it turns out that it's not the case. It turns out that this is also the proper bound for the L infinity norm of PQP. Let me state this. So a theorem which I proved 5 years ago now is that actually almost surely as n tends towards infinity, we have that PQP, so the L infinity norm, which you can think of as being the largest eigenvalue of this random matrix, tends towards phi plus. And from now on, let me. So I'm not going to say anything about this proof. This uses something which is called the theory of determinantal point processes in random matrix theory. So there is a fair amount of analysis involved into that. Let's say that now I won't care at all about phi minus anymore. So let me call. However, I will need to play with many alphas and betas. So as you guess, one of them is going to turn into T, but that would be more than that. So I'm going to call phi alpha and beta this phi plus, and I'm going to give a partial answer for this result. Okay. So for this, I need to introduce the following probability vector. So let beta t in r k decreasing be the following probability vector. Be the probability vector, which is defined as follows. So beta t of 1 is phi t 1 over k, then beta t of 2 is phi t 2 over k minus phi t 1 over k. So then you guess what is going on each time I make the difference. Let me write the next one. Beta 3 t is phi T3 over K minus phi T2 over K, and so on and so forth. And at some point, I will end up with zero. So it follows from the definition of phi plus and minus that this is indeed a decreasing sequence. And now there is this well-known concept of a majorization, which I was not aware of until recently, which says that if one looks at we are going to say that if I take x and y who belong to r plus k decreasing, we say that x majorizes, well, y majorizes x if and only if for all j we have that sum for I between 1 and j of xi is less or equal sum for 1 up to j of yj, which allows us to define, maybe I still keep this for a while. So with this, we can define the set S of Y of probability vectors X, which are majorized by Y. And now we are able to state the main theorem which I want to speak about today, which is that for all epsilon strictly greater than zero, almost surely as n tends towards infinity, we have that kn is included in s beta t plus epsilon, where here I mean a ball of size epsilon in the simplex of probability vectors around that that compact set. So I probably want to say one word about the proof, because it is closely related to that function phi here, obviously, because we need it for the definition of beta t. So what the impression that I had for a while though is that this theorem is not optimal. We could still improve it, provided that we could get better theorems here, not only for the product of two projections, but for the norms of more complicated matrices. And of course, in view of the improvement of Hastings' result, which Christopher King talked about yesterday, and in view of what I'm going to say as well, well, we have an actual indication that this is this bound can be improved. So how does the proof work quickly? Usually, well, it's not the first time. Just one comment before: it's not the first time that people in free probability or in operator algebra are interested by the problem of convergence of norms instead of the problem of convergence of moments. For example, there is one very celebrated result in free probability, which is due to Hagerup and Torbjörnsson, where they proved a much more general result than this one, but not in the case of unitary matrices in the case of Gaussian matrices. Basically, they prove that the norm of any polynomial in Gaussian matrices converges towards what one expects it to do. And basically, this is what we would need in the unitary case, and with constant matrices on top of that, to improve these results. But when one looks at the result, of course, of Hagerup and Torgersen, it looks quite difficult to improve it a lot without a big pain. So, and the other thing is that in operator algebra, usually what people are doing is they have an almost sure convergence result, and then what they do is they say, well, almost sure is a probability one set, and the probability one set is non-empty, so let's just pick one and we are done. Actually, what we want to do here is something just a little bit more conceptual. What we want to say is that any finite intersection of probability one sets is non-empty to prove this result. So how do we prove this result? Basically, what we have to do is to consider on one side, so recall that I have my V tense W here, that this is a large dimensional and this is a fixed dimensional. And what I have to do is to take, let's say, subspace VI tense W here. And this here is, let's say, of dimension I. And on the other hand, I always have my random space M. And now, which should be my projections? I should take a projection P to be onto this space, and Q to be onto that space. So it turns out Q is a projection onto that space. It turns out, so Q will be of relative rank T. Okay, so this is to be relative rank is going to be T, and here the relative rank is going to be I over K. So if you want, I'm going to set alpha equals T here, I'm going to set beta equals I over K, which looks very much like what I did here. Okay? And then there is this always used absorption trick, which says that actually it's enough to suppose that only one of the two matrices one of the two spaces are random, or only one of the two projections alternatively are random. So P is fixed here, and it is really fixed according to that tensor product structure, and M is random. And what this result here tells me is that I have a norm estimate on the product of PQ, on the norm of PQP. Now I have more than that. I could take another VI, a third VI. I could take lots of such VIs, maybe 1,000 or anything which is good enough. And if I would look at the soup over all this wouldn't, since I'm taking a finite number of them, I wouldn't change phi plus. But now if I'm taking a grid which is nice enough over the Grassmannian over that finite dimensional space, I'm going to approximate. This gives me a bound for lambda 1 plus lambda I by the minimax theorem. So basically, this is how the proof works. And now let's look at the applications. Well, the obvious application is that since the entropies are sure concave, what we have is that almost surely, so I can write it as a corollary, I have that almost surely as n tends towards infinity, we have that h p min of m is at least the entropy of HP of beta T. And once we have this, I can write something like this, the limit int of this satisfies this property. And once I have this, well, I'm just left with trying to play with that on one side, trying to estimate this on one side, and trying to estimate the entropy on the bi channel on the other side. And what we can obtain, for example, is that a corollary that we can obtain is that for any t which belongs to 0, 1, there exists a k. There exists some integer k, large enough, which we can compute easily by evaluating this and that, such that almost surely we have that the minimum output entropy. So here I'm switching back to Ion's notation. HP min of phi tens phi conjugate is strictly less than twice HP min of phi, where of course I mean that my phi is associated to the unitary to the isometric embedding to any isometric embedding of M into V tens W. So what is interesting, if I understand correctly, the small well, basically all these arose from trying to understand what Patrick Hayden and Andreas Winter had been doing. Well, if I understand properly, the improvement here is that we can do it for any t. So, for example, t equals 1/2, which just means coupling by two-dimensional space, also works. And well, I guess I'm going to stop here.